In terms of first question to the person that has been a lecturer here, in terms of looking at this speech and the non-summarized points that have been made, I would like to ask, what was your personal view of the person that we've been talking about, and what your personal take is on his effects on socialism? What effects have you seen this man have, and do you think it's more of a positive, negative, or more predetermined viewpoint in that perspective?
My personal view is that it sounds overall that he had a fairly negative effect on socialism generally, and I think largely in terms of bringing it into disrepute. In terms of Gitlitz's book, fact that he has been resurrected as a meme, and at certain point in time his name ranked higher than Trotsky's on a search for Trotskyism is interesting at the moment. And of course, any icon, any person can be reclaimed and turned into something that they weren't. But in terms of his effect on the personal lives of those around him, I would say fairly baleful. But he led a successful strike. He must have been a halfway competent trade union organizer and trade unionist. In the end, I think that he is an exemplar of a problem of one of the professional revolutionary. So the fact that he relied on income from this the Fourth International, which was based on sending money to some very small groups, but also some fairly small groups of personalities who ran the whole thing. I mean, they'd have conferences of six people somewhere in Spain or France or something like that. That would be the meeting of the International. But obviously, some sections had more money than others, like the Socialist Workers' Party in the United States. So I don't think that he personally was a great example to the rest of the world and had a great effect. But I think he's certainly interesting to look at. And the book about him is worth reading.
Thank you very much for your talk. It was very interesting, invigorating. However, I think for some of us, it may be good to have a few books to look at into if we want to look at this research ourselves, what we could look at. Well, thank you very much.
Right. Having finished now, Mike Foster next, please. Thank you. Hey, Mike.
Hello there. Yeah, thanks very much for that. Yeah, it was a very interesting talk, and it sounds like a fascinating bloke, and his thought seems to sort of tap into quite a lot of sort of common sort of threads and currents and interests in the I'm guessing the time he was writing was, I don't know, the 40s, 50s. All the alien and the nuclear war stuff. So right up my street, that's a particular sort of interest of mine. I'd say that particular sort of mood, which sort of coloured that part of the last century. And I suppose it was more of a point than a question that I don't know how much the context of his views on aliens and nuclear war were sort of shaped by. It's not really a movement, but the sort of the contactees, so-called, which were quite prominent in North America from the late 40s into the 50s. These are people who believed or claimed that they had met with aliens. The aliens were normally sort of quite tall, Nordic, sort of messiah-like characters who warned us against nuclear weapons and, gave... very vague, positive messages about, living in harmony in a sort of much less overtly political way than the views you described. That was quite a sort of a craze at the time that aliens could sort of see the way to a utopia of peace and harmony. And but a difference is, of course, that they these alien visitors they were quite unanimous in their dislike of nuclear weapons. But of course, your chap, he had the opposite view. So yeah, I suppose it was just me to sort of I wanted to just as I point out, I don't know how much of that sort of context affected his thoughts directly, but he seemed to sort of tap into something which was on the fringes of sort of culture around about the middle of the last century. Yeah, thank you.
The chap in his organization sort of like started the question was a guy called Minazzoli. And although I've got the book in front of me, I mean, some of these questions back as far as materialism and imperial criticism of Lenin. So it's kind of stemming off that sort of text within the wider Leninist movement and dialectical materialism. But very much, so it was 1967 when he made the speech to the Congress to try and shut the matter down and stop Minazzoli. And very much that's coming out of the contactee movement and UFOs and that sort of thing in the United States, and as it was spread around as a concept in the rest of the world. So, and it was tapping into all of the associated ideas and projections, because obviously there's a lot of stuff. I once wrote a dissertation on the X-Files. So the idea that the I want to believe and that the aliens are out there and that there's someone out there watching us is very much an impulse. And of course, there's this double-edged thing of we can see ourselves reflected. They can reflect their hopes and desires onto the alien, or they can see it as another that's a threatening, menacing creature, very much like the fairies that wanted to steal the children 300-400 years ago. Certainly that's the kind of like the intellectual milieu that he's tapping into when he made that speech and coming out of. So he was active from the 1930s pretty much up until the 1970s, but the kind of the peak was the 1950s and the 1960s. And I mean, I should have said that he was actually eventually arrested and expelled from Argentina for his radicalism, and members of his organization were murdered by right-wing American government in the 1960s and things like that. So this wasn't a laughing matter for them, I suppose, is kind of...
I'd like to come back on that, Mike.
No, that's okay, thanks. No, but yeah, interesting stuff. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Dougie up next. Dougie, what
are you? Yeah, I saw a film about Cuba once, and you know, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, Che Guevara actually wanted to nuke America, and I think Fidel Castro put a stop to it. As far as I remember when I saw the film, is that actually the case? And if they did nuke America, Cuba wouldn't have lasted very long, really. You know, but I mean, anyway, it's interesting to say that they thought nuclear war was inevitable and communism could come out of the remnants or whatever in places that weren't nuked or whatever. What was that idea widely held in South America and things?
I don't know if the idea was widely held in South America. In terms of, I mean, Gitlitz's book interviews or has notes from a guy called Dave Broder, who was in the British section of the Trotskyist International, of Revolutionary Workers Party Trotskyist, the British branch. And he said he was so outraged by what America was doing in Vietnam, he was prepared to die and sacrifice himself in the glorious thermonuclear blaze if it led to the downfall of America and the start of the New World. And I think that Castro didn't stop it. Castro was in favour of the nuke. I think it was Khrushchev who thought, who the hell are these nutcases that want a nuclear war? So, I mean, in terms of, we do have to be slightly thankful to Khrushchev for not starting the nuclear war in 1962 when the Cubans were, and they likewise were prepared to die. You know, they were prepared to give their lives for the cause if it meant ultimate victory, which is... they're prepared to die and they're prepared to take an awful lot of people with them. I think that's another example of the dangers of kind of millenarianism and the false equation of finite lives now versus infinite generations to follow, which is a fairly repugnant idea. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, both.
Right. Next up is Darren. Good, Darren.
Hi, Bill. This is more a question about Posadism internationally. I don't have a lot of knowledge about Trotskyism in Latin America, but I do understand that it has been a relatively large movement. I remember reading somewhere, and I think you might have touched on it in the talk, Bolivia was one of the few places where, if you like, the Trotskyists actually sort of, you tried to initiate like their version of a revolution. I guess I'm just curious why Posadism exported, you know, to Britain. You know, it's quite unusual to have like Trotskyist International in Britain, where the parent body is actually based in Latin America. And I guess just I'm curious from like your reading of the book on Posadas, you know, what was the origins? You know, I understand the Posadas actually ended up in the Labour Party as like deep interests, and they published a paper called, I believe it was The Red Flag, which was, I understand, I've only seen a couple of copies years ago, and it was almost like just like, you know, the magazine was just littered with speeches of Posadas himself. And I'm just curious, you know, who the hell did such a sort of strange organization basically gain roots in Britain? You know, it just seems such an anomaly. You know, it's so strange when there's other Trotskyist traditions from Latin America which didn't seem to have their own British section. I mean, there's Gitlis mentioned that came about in the book, etc.
Well, certainly, I think I memory for the leftist alphabet spaghetti of the difference between the BLA and the OLCS or whatever the various groups it escapes me. I think from my reading of what he was saying, because Posadas Cristalli had been very loyal to Pablo and was very much a creation of the Trotskyist Fourth International, and he made his move to totally take on control of it, believed that he could build the international. And so once he expelled, as it were, he split away, but, you know, effectively he intended that he'd expelled them, they'd expelled him, and all this sort of nonsense, the factional manoeuvring within the international secretariat, or I've been told off before for confusing the international secretariat with the international committee for and the various permutations of the splinters of the Fourth International, which I don't have the org chart or the family tree in front of me. I think that he was staking his claim. So his argument was, when he split away, that it was too Eurocentric, essentially, and it was not serving, and it was too nationalistic. There was nationalist deviations going on all over the place within the various Trotskyist organisations in Europe. Possibly, I can't remember if there was some argument about the whole issue of orientation towards communist parties as well. Essentially, he was making a play for the control of the international, failed, and so therefore he set up his own international. I suppose it is unusual because most of the other international movements of this sort were usually founded by your Maoists, your Leninists. They come with a state behind them, eventually spread them, and Hoxerists spread by as an official ideology of a particular communist group that ruled as a state. So it is unusual to have a sort of like an international that managed to set up, and how he managed to do it, how he managed to attract people, to be partly based on his reputation, and quite how people ended up in Britain across this organisation. They must have done it through, and I think Gitlitz's book doesn't quite touch on that. I think that would be an interesting follow-up, is how did the British section get set up? But clearly, he was working at building sections and sending his loyal acolytes out. Like I say, he sent his son, I think it was his son, Leon, to Syria, all places, with the intention of setting up an organisation. And I suppose, given that the organisation he was a member of was essentially set up by a group of people in a coffee shop, but then they managed to win some links to trade unionists in Latin America. Of course, what they did was they tried to get trade unionists, it describes in the book, to stand as candidates for election. There must have been some authenticity about him that managed to sell the brand that he was the authentic genius to lead the revolution. Thank you, Chair.
Darren.
Yeah, just as an aside, Bill mentioned it's kind of it's a very weird connection. He mentioned Oleg Vernik and the Ukrainian scam. A couple of days ago on social media, it turns out that he's still around, and he's actually now, his organization in Ukraine is now affiliated to the Morenost tradition in Argentina. So it's kind of, I just found it kind of funny that some people don't know about the Ukrainian scam, others might not on this list. But yeah, Vernik is actually around, and anybody wants me to send sort of links, I'll send them to him. But they're actually affiliated now to an Argentinian Trotskyist organization, which is actually quite big. That's why I was asking the question about Posadas, because Posadas tradition, relatively, you know, in the spaghetti soup of Argentinian Trotskyism, was always kind of quite small. Yeah, he's still knocking around, and his parent body now is the Morenos International, based out of Argentina. Just I'll throw that in.
Thank you, Darren. Next in the queue line is Adam. Okay, Adam.
Yeah, I've not read the book, but somebody who has, and he was going to review it. I just want to ask a question about Gitlitz, the author. Apparently, he takes a similar position towards Leninism as we do, and even as to what communism or socialism will be like, no wages system and so on. Is that the case? I mean, you've read the book. What is Gitlitz's approach? Is he an anarchist or something?
Honest with you, I couldn't get a handle on his personal politics. I mean, it could be that it kept it back. Maybe he thought the criticism stood for themselves. Mostly, the angle is very much on the turn of Posadas as this symbol of hope, and things moving onwards. I don't know. I've not flicked through the conclusions, so I'm going to get to the conclusions. It's more of a kind of an idea of hope. I mean, just looking at the blurbs on the back and how they're trying to sell the book, the quote from Kim Stanley Robinson, Gitlitz shows how explosions of black political humour also contain utopian hopes very necessary to keep alive. As an advocate of partially automated adequate socialism, I can only agree and applaud this fine book. But he's got some fairly good plaudits. In fact, Dave Broder, who was one of the Trotskyists, one of the Posadists in Britain, also supports it. I don't know quite what Gitlitz's own positions were. I mean, I just kind of read the book as it was. It'd be interesting to know. I mean, clearly, I don't think he's supporting Posadas, and I think he's building towards a case as well. In that, I think he very much brings forward that he wasn't extraordinary and very strange character. He was a Trotskyist of the common garden variety. It's just this one famous speech that seems to have picked him out.
Anybody else with any questions or comments regards to the talk tonight?
We're talking about Trotskyism, and Darren mentioned the Ukrainian scam, and I sort of remember that, not in great detail. I mean, perhaps somebody could explain in a little bit more detail what it was, but the individual concerned who was sort of scamming the party, I think it was back, I don't know how long ago, 10, 15 years ago, maybe more, was also sort of scamming other parties at the time. I mean, he's scamming the party, don't think he got much out of the party in financial terms anyway. But it's interesting to know that he is now a sort of full-blown Trotskyist. Or was he trying to sort of, was he trying entry, was it Trotsky's entryism into the party, or what was it? I don't know whether anyone can shed any light on that.
Well, at head office, so it's 20 years ago now. And basically, yes, so they exploded onto the scene when suddenly various groups on the fringes of groups, so ourselves, the Ashbourne Court Group, the American De Leonist Party, and a few others, suddenly all developed at about the same time. Ukrainian sections. And then people started digging because they saw this started ringing alarm bells. I think Darren did an awful lot of the digging and a lot of the exposing. And I think John Bissett might have had a hand as well. Now, as I recall at the time, the guy, the ringleader, was actually a member of the Committee for Workers International. So that's affiliated to the former militant stroke SPEW group in this country, the TAFists. Anyone can correct me on that. And I think basically they just learned fairly quickly that by repeating back what these groups wanted to hear, say we are a group in the former Soviet Union who believe in the true socialism and want to set up an international section of your group, will you send us a little bit of money? We sent a few people over. Danny Lambert was one of them. I can't remember. Vince Otter was there as well, I think. And they went over, I think, excuse me, Russian to them, went over. I think there's a couple of £1,000 in total were involved before the scam was exposed. And I think that there was, he tried to explain away that it wasn't a scam, but memory of the actual details. But I mean, the substantive point of the relation, what I raise it is, you know, you've got groups that are fairly associated around the world, but one group has a pot of money. They get contact with an individual in another group who's willing to say, make the noises saying, we are going to be the faction of your organization, and we're willing to send money. So on a much smaller scale, I think that there is some similarity to what was, I understand, reading Gitlitz's book, The Material Basis, or The Emergence of Posadas as a worldwide historical character. Except, of course, that the Fourth International had an awful lot more money because they had some sections that were serious national parties with tens of thousands. I think the SWP in America, the Socialist Workers' Party there, was quite a substantial organisation. And, of course, the groups got money from Cuba and the like. And so it was much easier for them to build, I recall Darren calling, Potemkin villages of internationalism.
I mean, I do. Sorry, Brian, my cues aren't working on the screen for some reason. But I do remember that the Ukrainian character actually turned up at, I think it was a delegate meeting at head office, and sort of made the right noises there. It was, and I think the party had paid his expenses. I mean, quite a remarkable piece of effrontery, really. And at that point, he was still getting away with it.
Dougie, you've popped up again.
I've no comment to that, Chair.
If you would, then, please. Thank you.
I seem to remember that Daniel Lambert hung up his jacket in a restaurant or a pub and got his wallet stolen, and it was probably stolen by the people that scammed us or whatever in that case. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that.
Can I just make a comment? I've just posted a link in the general section, the tech section, of a link to a YouTube interview with Gitlitz, with the guy who runs Zero Books. Turns out Gitlitz is actually based out of Brooklyn, so, you know, I could actually knock on his door, I guess. I've not watched the video. It's like over an hour long, but it's obviously just, you know, him talking about the book and, you know, et cetera. Just thought I'd throw that in.
And what text channel is it, I think, Darren?
It's in general. I mean, I could put it in the queue here. You know, I could actually put it in the queue, and so people could just see it.
If you do that, please.
Yeah, I've just done that. So, you know, I just stumbled across it because I was curious myself about his politics and his background, you know, so maybe that'll give further information.